afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Lunchtime Miss Alany with me, Maurice Newman. As you've become, probably becoming accustomed now, this being the third week, Friday's our books programme. Today, I'm going to be talking to Julianne Mooney, the programme director for the Dublin Book Festival. And later on, after the break, I'm hoping to be talking to Idel Cushionan about her new book, The Ladybird Flies. Time permitting, I'll also talk a little bit about fashions in science fiction and have an extract from Noel Amayenda's work, The Smolt Protocol. I did also plan to talk a little bit about dialogue and how to write it, but we'll have to see how we're fixed for time. All today's tunes are from Dionne Warwick. She'll be singing songs from the Bacharach and David songbook. And here's the first one, just to get us started. Well, hello. We seem to have had a bit of a problem reaching Julianne at the book festival. I'm sure they're very busy down there. It's a big event for the city, taking place in the Smock Alley Theatre in town. So I'm going to jump ahead and I'm going to have a little talk about science fiction. There are millions of science fiction fans around. And I, although I'm no longer the avid reader of science fiction that I was as a younger person, I still do pick one up now and again. I was first introduced to science fiction at the age of about 11 or 12. A teacher gave me a book called Red Planet by Robert Heinlein. Up until that point, I suppose I'd really not been stretched much in the reading that I'd been doing. I might have been Biggles and Post, Enid Blyton. But Heinlein introduced a whole new genre to me, and I became a very, very avid reader of science fiction, and went on. Red Planet is very much a book that a younger person can read. It's quite short. It's a very simple story. And straightforward. The concepts are nothing too difficult to get your head around. I subsequently went on to read many of Heinlein's great books. He was a great producer of brick-like 500- and 600-page monolithic works like Stranger in a Strange Land. The Moon is a Harsh Mistress was another one. Starship Troopers. These were a kind of steady diet for me until I was about 17. And about that age, I discovered Kurt Vonnegut. Vonnegut changed my worldview and changed a lot of people's. I mean, Vonnegut is now on the national curriculum for the USA in many universities and secondary schools. The first one I read was Slaughterhouse-Five, which is based on Vonnegut's experiences in the Second World War. He was in Dresden in the firestorm. He actually survived the firestorm as a prisoner of war, and he and his comrades were taken from the slaughterhouse where they were being kept after the raid and put to work digging up bodies. It was a traumatic experience for Vonnegut, and one which plagued him throughout his life. And subsequent to that, we came up with he wrote Sirens of Titan. Both of these play around with the idea of time. We tend, it's normal for people to view time as something that goes forward like an arrow. Something happens, it's finished, and there's nothing you can do about it. A cup falls, it breaks, it's never the same again. You cannot go back. Vonnegut posits the idea that everything is happening all the time in every universe, and his characters tend to travel about in time and place, playing with this idea of everything still being happening. So you can be in Rome watching Nero fiddle while the city burns, and you can be in New York when the Twin Towers fall at the same time. It needs a stretch. You need to think about what you're reading, but it's also humorous, and you're not at any stage scratching your head and wondering what's going on. He explains his theories very, very well and very simply in a very moving way. He also wrote Cat's Cradle. This introduces a fantastic idea. It's Ice-9. And Ice-9 is a molecule that if it touches water, it freezes it. And it doesn't matter where the water is. So if you drop one molecule of Ice-9 into the sea, all the water on the planet will freeze immediately. And if you lick a molecule of ice 9, all the water in your body will freeze. And it's a kind of end of the world novel, really well worth having a look at. A lot of Vonnegut's later works, where he starts looking at American life, like Mother Night and novels of the time, tend to be, for me, a little bit dull. But if you see any science fiction written by Vonnegut, pick it up immediately. Later on, I kind of had a flirtation, if you like, with Asimov, the iRobot genre. And they were okay, and he's sort of the father of modern robotics and all that, but I found them kind of dull. I suppose after Vonnegut, Asimov is a little bit too staid. It's like reading an engineer after you've been reading a poet. Others like Poole Anderson also, good ideas and good stories, but just not with that incredible flair. As time went on, I realised that what I really, really enjoy in science fiction is humour. And if you can get, if you can have a laugh while having your mind blown by some amazing concept, then you're doing well. And I think one of the greatest advocates of humorous science fiction was Robert Sheckley. And a good sample of his work would be Dimension of Miracles. In this book, the hero is called Carmody. And we're talking in the 1950s, so there isn't really space travel or anything. So by some slip of the universe, Carmody is taken off the planet by an alien, a flying saucer. And he finds himself outside Earth. And it turns out that in the universe there is a karmic force, if you like, in which everybody and everything in the world has a natural predator. On Earth, if you're human and you live as Carmody does in New York City, your natural predator or natural predators are motor cars that can knock you down, muggers that can kill you, any form of accident, falling buildings, plane crashes. These are all your natural predators. So when Carmody is taken out and away from the Earth, he suddenly has no predator. So the universe invents one for him. And he comes across this thing, he meets the Carmody Hunter. This thing has no other purpose in the world except to eat Carmody. And it can change into anything that it wants to do. So he can walk into a hotel and the hotel turns out to be the Carmody Hunter. It's actually a lot funnier than it sounds. if you see that, I suggest you try it. Another fantastic and humorous writer would be Eric Frank Russell. If you see a book called Next of Kin, just buy it. It's kind of catch-22 for written in the 50s. The character is a rebel, a soldier who just is prone to breaking the law, but also just a masterpiece of comic writing. There are epic science fiction writers, and these are marvellous things to get into if you can. And for me, the greatest is Dune. By Frank Herbert. There's a whole series of these now, Dune, Messiah and what have us, but the actual book Dune is kind of like Lord of the Rings in space, although not as long and a little more action-packed. There was a film made of this, and it was directed by David Lynch, who did Blue Velvet and Twin Peaks and stuff like that. And it stars Kyle MacLachlan, who was actually in both of those films. But in the film of Dune, MacLachlan chooses, interestingly, I thought, to play the hero, Paul Atreides, like a sort of gay Captain Hook. For me, it didn't work. It was a little bit too off-kilter. These days, I read in a lot sort of wider tranche of styles and genres. I don't stick with one and maintain that that's the only one worth reading. But I still drop into science fiction now and then. Well, my current favourite is Ian M. Banks. Banks died very recently. I think he died last year or the year before, a Scottish writer. And he wrote fiction and sort of thriller fiction under the name Ian Banks. And when he puts the M in, Ian M. Banks, he's now writing science fiction. This is incredible stuff. His culture novels are set in the future, and what they do is give us a future in which the world is run by computers, which is normally what you would call a dystopian epic. You would think that, oh, the future is going to be horrible and the computers are going to enslave us all, and it'd be like Terminator. In Banks's culture novels, it's kind of all right. The computers are nice. They're clever and they keep us as pets and they look after us. And it's all rather lovely. All in all, you have to remember that science fiction writing it has to be the most difficult kind of writing to do. Not only do you have to think of a plot and characters, an ending and a beginning and a middle, but you have to invent a whole universe, a culture, a worldview. It demands an imagination that I simply don't have. It's just completely beyond me. Now, also remember, don't be put off by that. Writing is a pleasure. We focus too much on success. And I've mentioned like half a dozen writers here, but there are tens of thousands of them out there. You can't assume that you're going to be famous just because you've actually managed to finish a book. That's only the beginning. And the same probably goes for people who think their son will one day play for Manchester United. Now, I'm just going to play a piece here from Noel, who I spoke to last week about the Malahide Writers Group. And I hope you enjoy it. It's from her book. It's called The Smolt Protocol. And hopefully it'll come on now. Smolt Protocol.
What the hell is going on? Shh, Mark, please, she urged, opening the door to a small, empty courtyard. She indicated a bench in the corner. As they walked over, Mark began. You dropped this bombshell on me last night. They don't answer my messages all day, and now I see you talking with that freak. He was outside with the protesters yesterday, covered in blue paint. Oh, you saw him then? That's most unfortunate. I think he was wanting to be seen, Sanya. He was waving around a placard. He raved about cosmic rays. What's really going on here? She nodded her head and sat down. I can see you might be anxious. Yes, I'm bloody well anxious. Mark plunked himself beside her, leaving an angry 30 centimetres between them. Marcus, as I said last night, we're carrying out an intense observing run soon, and we need your help. There's nobody better at analysing high-energy atmospheric interactions. Marcus wasn't doing a good job of hiding his doubt. Sonia sat back and folded her fingers together. Maybe I should explain something. Something about me leaving for Berlin. Marcus looked down. This would not be pleasant. Marcus, I know I left you in the middle of your PhD. It was my one regret about leaving Dublin. Really? He met her gaze with sceptical eyes. Yes, I wanted you to come join our new group in Berlin. Oh yeah? So why had she never said so? But you were doing great work in Dublin, all on your own, pretty much. I didn't want to disturb that. He sighed, not dignifying that with a response. It sounded like she was placating a 2-year-old. In fact, I could see that you were going down the same road, following the black hole theory. And I wanted to see what you could come up with independently. I've been following your work intensely. It was so little evidence, Marcus. You've had some brilliant insights. Now Marcus's jaw dropped. He thought he'd been abandoned by a disinterested supervisor, but she now claimed that it was all in pursuit of scientific excellence. Oh, he said, trying to keep the emotion out of his voice, probably failing. I had no idea. I'm sorry, Marcus. It was underhanded. But I truly believed then that you're better off working on your own. Mark swallowed. And now? Now we need some more measurements. So how about it? You in? I don't know, Sonia. I'll see what I can do to get some time off. Here's some literature to read through. There's a training course coming up next week. Can you be there? Sonia, fascinating as this is, I've a job and a few responsibilities. I know. She put down her satchel and looked him straight in the eye. I'm asking you to trust me on this, Mark. You won't regret it, I'm certain. Trust. He had trusted her before. He held her gaze a moment longer, then dropped his eyes to leaflets. So what about this blue guy? Is he mixed up in all of this? Sonia tilted her head. Well, he's an external consultant, you could say. I warned him not to go out like that. Oh yeah? Marcus, She fixed him with a steady gaze. You have good reason not to trust me. I understand that. But I know who you are, and I trust you. I hadn't intended telling you just yet. Well, here we are. I'm going to tell you something that might go some way to helping you to trust me. I just need your promise to keep it a secret. He didn't respond. What was he getting into? The door to the foyer banged open. Sonia! It was bloody Duncan. We need to get going, he said, looking only to her, ignoring Mark. Okay, Sonia said, looking between Mark and the door. I'll be there in a minute. Taxi outside now. He stood his ground. Train leaves in 25 minutes. All right, Duncan, 1 minute. She glanced at her watch and stood up. Mark followed suit. Then she leaned forward to whisper to him. Sorry to rush you on this, Marcus. Can I have your word? What the hell? He sighed. Go ahead, I promise. Sonia drew a deep breath. His name is Farouk and... Her voice petered away. Marcus gestured with his hand for her to proceed, ignoring Duncan's glaring presence over by the door. Well, the thing about him being blue yesterday. Yes? She looked him straight in the eye. Mark, listen. It wasn't paint.
Julianne?
Yes, hello?
Oh, hiya. I'm sorry, yeah, Julianne. Had you on hold there for quite a long time.
No problem.
Okay. I'm just going to let the listeners know that Julianne Mooney here is the programme director for the Dublin Book Festival. It's running up until Sunday. And yeah. I believe there are many, many events and some very famous writers in attendance. Can you tell us anything about that, please, Julianne?
Yes, there's. We've got a huge number of events running over the next few days. Tomorrow morning we've got Dublin City Public Library's Reader's Day. So we've got a variety of different authors, including Roisin Ingle, actually, and Marty Whelan will be on discussing their new books. We also have, something for everyone. There's a history event on as well with Turtle Bunbury, Fergal McGarry and Lucy McDermott. And they're going to be talking about the people of the 1916 Rising. So they'll be talking about actors who were actually involved in the uprising, women and children as well. So the people you may not have realised who were involved. We've got authors like Dermot Bulger, Nuala Nkongkor, Anne Enright. So there's a huge number of events on with lots of names, both established and up-and-coming authors as well.
Yeah, it's hardly surprising that the 1916 sort of commemorations are playing sort of quite a significant part in this year's festival.
I suppose we have a lot of the books kind of came out quite early. They're out already. So we have the 1916 event that I discussed, but we also have a range of 1916 walking tours where the authors of the books actually are going to take people out onto the streets and go to kind of the significant places like the GPO and other places to show people, you know, where the actual uprising happened and what happened in those spots as well.
Right. I recently did a ghost tour of Dublin in which there was a tour around the town and actors acted out some of the scenes of the murders that had taken part there. Will there be actors on these walking tours acting out events of the day?
They won't, actually, not in the 1916 walking tours, unfortunately. We do have the literary walking tour with Pat Liddy, who himself is like an actor. He's so flamboyant. He's so interesting. He knows Dublin so well and lots of kind of quirky little spots. And that's the literary walking tour on Saturday and Sunday. So that should be a lot of fun.
Oh, jolly good. And are there lots of tickets around for these walks still, or are they sold out?
Well, the 1916 tours, unfortunately, are sold out. Literary walking tour, we do still have tickets left, but I always say just drop in, because a lot of our events are free, and so if you drop in, there'll be an event of some sort going on, and often, we kind of have a waiting list, so people do get on to the events that might be booked out, or the walking tours that might be booked out, and there's always, you know, people who know shows, especially if it's raining.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Anything on that might be of interest to sort of putative writers or people who are in the process of writing, involved in writing groups, like any of the talks?
Yeah, so we have an event tomorrow, actually starting at 3:30, and it's called Writing Long and Short, and that's with a variety of very well-known authors, including Dermot Bulger, Noonan O'Connor, Eilish Ndivna, and Donal Ryan, and they will be discussing about the different format of writing, so how they, you know, writing short stories, novels, writing for children. They'll be covering a huge kind of a wide variety of topics in writing. We also have a crime writing workshop up in the Irish Writers' Centre tomorrow morning on Saturday, and one that I'm looking forward to as well is writing for young adults and children. We've got Owen Colfer, John Connolly and Mary-Louise Fitzpatrick. They'll be discussing the different techniques and their experience of writing young adults, and obviously they all have huge writing experience, and so that should be a very, very interesting panel.
Yeah, I might pop along to a couple of those myself. I'm always sort of threatening to write a young adult book, but the ones I've attempted have always been, well, frankly, rubbish. Perhaps I could use a couple of tips. Perhaps the major tip I should take on is don't bother.
No, they'll give you plenty of encouragement. They're great. And, you know, the great thing about the festival is, you know, you actually get to meet the authors themselves as well. So while you'll sit down and listen to their tips, afterwards they always go upstairs. We've got a winter garden with a cafe and bookshop, and the authors go straight up there. So they talk with the audience. So it gives you one-on-one experience as well.
Oh, that sounds very interesting. Now you're going to have to try and keep me away. I suggest you post Watchman and try and keep me out with a stick.
No, we'll let you in, don't worry.
Okay then, I'll do that. Sadly, we're a little bit out of kilter on the running order, so I'm going to have to go into a break now, and then I've got someone else on afterwards, so I'm just going to have to say thanks very much. Would you like to quickly give us a contact number, like tell the listeners the website address if they want to book a ticket or see what's happening?
Yeah, so if you go to dublinbookfestival.com and you can book online or even drop by as well. We've got the winter garden with the bookshop, there's a children's area where you could just read a book for both children and an adult reading area, and you can book tickets on the desk. But do go to dublinbookfestival.com as well.
Right, well, that's great. Thanks very much, Julie. Well, thanks
all
for,
right,
thanks
thank
for calling
so
me
much.
Back. All the best.
Okay,
bye,
sorry
bye
about that. Thank you. Bye.
Your 24-hour community station.
867 1190.
Near FM.
Adele?
Hello, Mark.
Hello, Adele. Can you just hang on? Well, stay there. I'm just going to introduce you to the listeners. I have on the line at the moment Adele Cushionan. Adele's just published her book, The Ladybird Flies, and it will be launching in Malahide fairly soon. So, Adele, hello. Thank you for staying with me there. It's early days for me. I'm still having a few technical problems playing with...
Well, hello, Mark. It's great to be talking to you. Yes, my book is being launched this Wednesday, the 25th of November.
Brilliant.
At Malahide Library.
Excellent. And it's a thriller. You were telling me that it's a sort of... an experimental thriller or just sort of...
No, it's a very subtle tale of criminology. It's a murder story, and there is a death wish in the story. It's a one-day event, and this lady has a death wish, and she has told those closest to her but one person, her very nearest child, and she has to try and bring her on board to the day and the event. And, of course, the climax and the trouble of the story will unfold for the reader then.
Right. Sounds very intriguing. Is there a twist at the end? Is it something that's...
There is a twist at the end, yes. I do enjoy a book with a twist at the end. Maris, I got the idea that I am a mother myself and we're all going to have the end of our life, and how is I going to tell those closest and dearest to me what I wanted? And this mother then has left really that detail to the very end of her life. And there was a death form only in Farmley House in September, and we had, they called it a death cafe, and the piece you're reading from the novel is a death cafe situation, and they're trying to talk about death. And Catherine McGuinness chaired it. She's a retired judge. And Seamus Heaney's son, Mick Heaney, was also there, and he wrote about it 2 days later. that his own father, when he found out that he had to have an operation, he didn't talk about his death, funny enough, even though they were together the night before. But the son hugged his father, Seamus Heaney, and then Seamus texted to his wife and his child, don't be afraid. And I think those situations that, you know, we need to talk about kind of death and dying because it's a definite fact. My favourite quote from Woody Allen and his book, Without Feathers, is, it's not that I'm afraid to die, I just don't want to be there when it happens. And it's a fantastic quote. And it's funny where you get your ideas from. But and even Clive James is very sick at the moment, that fantastic Australian broadcaster.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And he's writing beautiful poetry. He's a Japanese maple poem out, and it's about the leaves of autumn, and they're so vibrant and beautiful, and they're striking, and they just catch your eye, and then they're gone.
Did you ever read any of Clive James's biographies?
No, I don't. I haven't read Clive's biography. But you obviously liked it too.
Oh, it's marvellous. He is a fantastic writer. I used to read him when he wrote the TV reviews in The Observer 20 years ago.
He's great.
Oh, absolutely tremendous writer. A stylist of just unimaginable brilliance. Just, I don't know where they get it from. Superb.
And, you know, you have to write about life matters. He is dying of leukemia at the moment, and his 10-year-old granddaughter, he just brought her to the Harry Potter ride because he said he reached another landmark birthday and he's dying. And she bought the Harry Potter wand and just kind of whisked it over his head and wished him that he had a different time of his life now for her. But the reality is he doesn't. And that was only 6 days ago. He writes about this as well. So, you know, like, it is a very intriguing, compelling, it's a moral dilemma. I will ask the reader to choose a side because it is about choices and it's about who would you tell or who would you discuss this with. And that's really, we're in the month of November and there's going to be an empty chair around the Christmas table for families. Mm. And, you know, I just know that I have to find a way of talking about these things to my own children in my own day. My eldest is going to be turning 18 and I made a will, and I think that brought about, sparked the idea. My own father's 81 and handed me his will over a cup of coffee in a cafe, and he said, will you mind that for me? And it was just, I said, oh my God, it was a brown envelope, and of course, is there any money in that? But it's the will anyway. And then the next time we met for coffee, it was like an elephant in the room, Maris. He said to me, have you opened it? And I said, no, I didn't, Dad, because you're not dead, you know. And, you know, and I just didn't know where to go with it. And it's sitting like an imposter in my house beside my bed. And, you know, and out of respect, I'm glad he has entrusted me with his wishes. But I don't want to open them in case I want to query them or, you know, ask him about it or change his mind about it, because that's not my right. It's a duty as a daughter to find out what he wants. And my own mother died, Mars, of lung cancer, and I was with the consultant in Beaumont Hospital, and she was only 64, I was 39. And it was a very young doctor, had to tell her, unfortunately, the clouds on your lungs are not good, and you're going to die within 6 weeks. And the shock of both of us sitting there, you know, it was, and we came away, and I'm glad she got to tell me where she wanted to be buried, because she came up to Dublin at 18, a fantastic hairdresser. She's from Carlow, but she said, I'd like to go back home. And to me, Dublin was our home because I'm from Northside, I'm from Santry. This was our home. And if I didn't have that opportunity to know what her wishes were, and it's very important, there was four children and we were able to follow her wishes through. And there's real peace of mind in that, you know, and we didn't talk a lot about her death, but we did have her final wishes. Yeah, and really, that's really what this book would be about. And I hope people enjoy it and they see that I am talking about death in an engaging manner and in a respectful manner, even though there will be different characters with different strong opinions, and they're going to follow through on choices and bring about the action of the plot. But it's a 24-hour story, Mars. It happens in one day and it's one event, and, you know, how prepared are we ever for that one event?
Oh, very true. And as it happens, what you were saying about your mother not coming from Dublin, but you thinking she did, kind of, or always knowing her there, is that you become, I think it's when you get older that you realise, when you've got children yourself, you realise that your parents had a life before you came along.
Exactly.
And that's kind of a learning process in itself, and it's part of maturing. I suppose everybody goes through it. But as a child, you just think that this whole world exists to keep you going. Yes. And it's an interesting area. I mean, it's a massive area to explore, and I don't think you can explore it all. There isn't one great book of death, but there
no,
are many aspects
so.
Of it. You know, can I just to push it a little, lighten it a little bit, maybe? I'd like to talk about the what makes you initially made you think, like, I'm going to sit down today, I'm going to start writing. Had you always been a writer? Had you always thought you were going to write, or did you just the idea spring fully formed?
Well, English was my favourite subject in school. I loved PE. I loved getting out and, you know, doing sports. But there was a lot of drama in our school, and there was debates, and there was a lot of play on words and, you know, acting. And I really did enjoy English, so it was my favourite subject. And then I decided to study in college, and I went on to do a degree in English. And I had Frank McGinnis, the fantastic
Frank is a fellow pioneer.
Coach.
Sorry, that wasn't my opinion.
No, that's okay. So I was just lucky to have such a great professor. He was so interesting. And that just followed on through. And I think if you want to write, you will always want to write. It will never, ever leave you. And it's just kind of, it just sits with you the whole time. It's your company, it's your friend, it's your worst enemy, because it won't leave you alone. So yes, I was always writing, and I was always reading. I loved reading. I still love reading.
I think
we had the county,
County
Council sent around the library into our housing estate. So I pulled up outside my house, and you could just walk into it and ask to take a book out. And then the ladies on the road, I read Mills and Boone growing up. I remember telling Frank McGinnis, my professor, in my tutorial when we started.
You soppy
this
thing.
This is what I read. Are you okay there, Mars?
Yeah, no, I was just amused that you were reading Mills and Boone.
And he was very amused, but he came from a working class background. His dad, milkman. My dad was a mechanic, my mum a hairdresser. This was the only books I could get my hands on. So I'm delighted my first debut novel is not a romantic story, even though I would like to try that. I kind of wanted something more gritty, more very honest, and, you know, just setting it out there. A love story, of course, covers all those angles, as we all know, but this was just a different love story. It was a child and mother love story.
Actually, it's weird to hear, or not weird, but it's unusual to hear the words love story put in that context, child and parent. But of
child
course, it is a love relationship. You just tend not to use that phrase for it that often. And you're having to self-publish. Now, we had a brief chat yesterday, didn't we? In which we sort of just briefly touched on why one has to, in the end, think about self-publishing, because the traditional publishing houses are very, very cagey about taking people on. I have a statistic somewhere that the average publishing house in Ireland receives 2,000 manuscripts a year, unsolicited manuscripts each year, and publishes maybe 4 of them.
Yeah.
So this means that this growth in self-publishing is attracting a lot of people. Was it a process of rejection that led you to self-publishing, or did you always think that this would be a good route for you anyway?
Well, rejections did have a part to play in it. When I decided I was going to give my time to this, I wanted to do it. I made my own plan that if I didn't get published, I was going to self-publish anyway. So I was going to have a book at the end of the process. It's very hard to get feedback on a rejection. I got a dozen rejections, but they were very kind and good rejections in that, all in all, an interesting idea was quoted by Marianne O'Connor, but she said she wasn't the agent for it. And then other agents in London said the problem was getting the publisher for the story because it's about death. So it's marketability. So I could understand what they were saying to me, but this was my writer's voice, this was my character, and this is what came about when I was writing the story. And it did change, and, you know, it went in a direction that I wasn't completely in control of, so I really enjoyed it. And I wanted to stay with the story, and so I decided to self-publish. And I'm not digitally minded at all, Maris. I'm not IT or techie. This was Amazon, and they have a system that you can follow through a very good uploading profile, and then you have a file reviewer and you can look at your work. You just put your manuscript in a PDF format and upload it. Now,
That is a very simplified version. Of course, you spend 6 months editing and rereading.
Of course.
And then you have to follow their technical details. But 1% go through without any hitches. I was the 1%. I was dancing around my room. I converted. I literally did a zumba dance on a Sunday evening. Dinner was on the table and I came down. I just started going through. And they're all like looking at me like I'm a lunatic, you know. And but so it is possible to do. And it takes... However, it took me a year to write the book, and then it came back, and unfortunately you wait a good few weeks. You could be waiting over 3 months to get word back. It's a long time to wait. So 6 months passed, and then I decided to do it for the Christmas market this year. So it's been sold in Manor Books in Malahide on the 5th of December, Saturday morning from 10 till 12. So if you would like to gift the book with my signature on it, which I love doing. You're talking about the Dublin Book Festival before I'm talking to you, Maris, and that's a fantastic event. It's €5 a ticket or €3 on a concession, and there were so many free events. I met Anne Enright in the Baldoyle Library. There was a reading from her, and that was a free event, and she signed books that I then gifted for Christmas. Yeah. And Donna Ryan will be there tomorrow, and Sinead Gleeson is talking about her anthology of female writers. And Anne Enright is there tomorrow. And there are free, the literary walking tour, which I've never done. And I would have loved to do that, but I'm actually signed to go to Donal Rind and Enright's, both their programmes tomorrow. So I would always have been involved in going out and meeting the authors and writers and just listening to them. And the writing group in Malahide Library, I'm glad you read Noelle's piece. It is so interesting to hear a scientific project and the imagination. And she's a technical background in engineering, and you can see that in her work. The research is there. And it's so interesting because we all love George Clooney and Sandra Bullock's movie and Space Odyssey. I think it's a great area, and the writers group welcomes anybody who would like to come. It's a free event, the first Wednesday of every month, and it's in Malahide Library at 6:45. And please come along. And there was lovely poetry last week. And the first time this person read out their poem about like a lost love. And, you know, it's very interesting just to listen to the creative mind and people who want to write. You know,
so quite right, yeah.
Self-publishing is there.
Well, I think you need to meet people who are having similar thoughts, problems, no, not necessarily problems, just ideas and things that they want to do, and to encourage each other and to see that you're not alone or a bit of a loony, to actually know that what you're doing is a very normal and worthwhile thing. And it's great. I have been in a number of writing groups, and there was one that was in last year that actually encouraged me through a process of developing, like 1 week we'd have to write a character, 1 week we'd have to write sort of an event. And these individual little bits of writing, little exercises, actually form the beginning of a book, which
That's
I eventually
right,
wrote.
They do.
And apparently, my book too is not marketable. It's a very common phrase with the publishers.
Yeah.
So yours is not marketable because it's about death. Mine's not marketable because it's about bears.
Bears. well done. Well, maybe you'll go down the self-publishing route. I mean, tell friends. I think, I know Maeve Binchy. She started writing at 42. I'm 47. But when she started, she told nobody she was doing it because she was nearly afraid to admit it. Whereas, some writers suggest that you tell somebody you're doing it, and you're like, I told people 6 months ago I'm going to have a book launch, and then it makes you just sit your bum down and just do it. And and then if you tell friends what you're writing and the team, they will send information to you. And I got that great tip from Megan Wynn. She runs creative writing courses. She's from Loughshinny, and her courses are all around North County Dublin and further afield now, and her website is excellent. But she does a few weeks creative writing, and it's like what you said, 1 week you work on a character, another week you work on the plot, and you build up your kind of your complexity and your voice, and you just find your own comfort zone with your own skill. And it'll just happen. And I think anybody who's listening to this who wants to be a writer or wants to write, just go for it and enjoy it. If you don't enjoy it, you will enjoy it if you want to write, and it's very difficult, and you will be very critical of yourself.
Yes.
I mean, I must have read this book 11 times, Mars, before I actually uploaded it onto the machine. And even then, I started rereading it, and I said, you could constantly change the beginning, the start, the ending, but you have to say, well, I'm happy with that, and I'm just going to let it out there into the world and have its day.
Yeah, quite right. There has to be a day when you go, that is now
and
finished.
And the story is on one day, so that's interesting. I think I would just say to the reader, will they please choose, it'll be L or O, they'll take sides, and it'll be interesting to, they can tweet you or text you or follow in, which side would they choose? So it's L or O, and L is for Lily, it's one character, and O is for Olive.
Right, well, that's an interesting approach. Anyway, listen, thanks very much, Adele, for talking to us. That was really interesting.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I enjoyed it. And, you know, the time flies. I think I said yesterday we might run up to 20 minutes, and he said, oh, it's a long time. It's not, Adele, is it? It just goes.
No.
Okay, listen, I'm going to play a little clip from your novel now. We've got Oscar Kilbride Conlon to read it for us. He's a lovely fellow with a proper voice. So thanks very much, Adele. Sit back and listen to yourself.
Oh, thank you very much. Best of luck.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Frank is a fellow pioneer, like me, dear, with his humane acts of kindness. Mom tenderly agrees with the picture Mr. P has painted for me about the volunteer. Interesting that no one is labelling Frank's IMCA status to me. He is more a mental case himself than a mental advocate. Yet Mom holds Frank in her high esteem. Does he have a medical background? Kindness is a hard value to esteem in my way of thinking. I see hard facts. What's your training in? I directly asked Frank in a smart tone. He has to have heard the edge of my voice. They all did. But Frank chooses to ignore it. Reaching for his coffee cup, engrossed in the moment, eternity visits as he enacts the slowest of motions possible. The slower he moves, the faster my agitation spirals. Was he purposely egging me on to lose my cool? When he has placed the cup back down with a gracefulness a ballet dancer aspired to imitate, he gives me his time again. I am in training, he replies. Thank God. Training for what? It's out of me before I can censor the words. The directness is evident to everyone at the table. Maybe I should adopt a softer tone to belly my sharpness of mind. Too late now. I am a man of the cloth, in training. He speaks the English language, but I still need a translator. Thank God. Incenses me. I'm in between churches at present. Frank tips at my reserve some more. Mom senses my frustration and speaks out on behalf of the elusive Frank to quell my outbreak. Frank is trying to join the priesthood, dear. He's experienced a calling. Well, well, I exasperate, the sentiment laced with irony. I've never met a person who's had a calling. I'm talking in a breathless voice to deflect from my cumbersome attempt of assignation. This was true. I don't go to church. Did this give him an advantage over me, I thought? Nobody reacts to this challenge. They all sit around in surreal stillness. I view the party of misfits in my company. Mom is a unique character of openness. It was part and parcel of her medical life, but more so, it was part of her natural kindness towards people. She often cares for stray cats to meander past her doorway. Was Frank a stray predator? My mom has no wealth to speak of, I state, the accountant in me representing her interests. The combination of church and wealth, the given historical footing even I am aware of. How do I stop the heaviness I am bringing to the table as I tackle this man? Olive, streamlines Mom, please don't be so rude, dear. His eyebrows arc an ironic twist. I'm not interested in money. My interests are with the people. His staunch denial of interest in any monetary activity perplexes me more. Why would a man in his prime want to keep constant company with weak, dying people? A calling, I repeat again. Hell if I know what that means. Dear, there are elements of life you don't know the full meaning of, adds Mom lovingly. My parent was on my side again. I purposely include a standing of family at this juncture. Will Dad be here soon, Mom? I ask, while smiling kindly, although I'm hyperventilating. Fuck off, the lot of you hangers-on, I want to say aloud, but I would isolate them as soon as possible. I can only cut myself into so many pieces. Even I could not be in two places at the one time. I make a mental note to connect with Dad later. For now, I feel like a magnet, the forces of opposite directions pulling me in two different ways. I love Mom. My mom is my mom. I love Dad just as much, but differently. Did my father get it? I never wondered about this fact, but I do now. Within this forming of a self-help support group, this play of improvising actors, all of us playing a part in the final scene.
Okay, that was the
the end of the show, really. It just remains for me to thank Julianne Mooney from the Dublin Book Festival for talking to me. Thank Idel Cushnahan for having a chat about the ladybird flies. Remember, go along to the launch, buy the book. It sounds deeply interesting. I'd like to thank Oscar Kilbride Conlon for reading both of the pieces there. They were well done, Oscar. You're a good lad. And I'd just like to let you know that coming up is the dreaded Doug Rogers with jazz and swing music. Hold on to your hats. Following that is more books with cover to cover. And then Lisa Quinn at 4.30 will be reviewing the events of the past week. Thanks very much, and perhaps we'll speak again next Friday. Bye-bye.